Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 22, delivered on November 7th.
Today, applications of the weighted average cost of capital. Before I do that, quick look at the markets. How are we doing today on the markets? What would you say? No, you. No, there's not a ghost behind you. There might be, but we're not doing that right now. It's good. Is that kind of good or is that pretty good? Yeah, it's a strong up day. We're looking in the at the midday. The markets are all up strongly. In every case, better than, half a percent. And we also see over here that gold is easing back, which means that that would be one source of capital for the upsurge in the prices. And, of course, if we look at the bonds, though, interestingly enough, some money is a little tiny bit of money. No, that's not true. That's a strong amount of money. Money is flowing into bonds as well. So there seems to be a lot of positives going on. Primarily, the surge was a result of some good news on the trade front with China. Although we can see, if you look at the actual numbers here, well, I really hate it. That's really, no, that can't be. Oh, I was going to say. Okay, if you look right now, there was a real hard spike right there, a bull spike. It was like a steep cliff. It went up, and then it just dropped right back off that cliff. Something got everyone kinds of excited, and then they got a little bit sad afterwards, and there was a little bit of a sell-off. But the market is still doing pretty strongly. We see that right now the intraday high is 309.7. Which means that will be sort of the marker, see if it can find its way back up there. It's eased back off that to 309.3, but still it's a pretty strong day for the market. And as you can see, it wasn't just the NASDAQ, it wasn't just the Standard & Poor's 500 that did well. It was all of the market. It's a broad-based rally, as we would say. If I can get back to that. Well, let's try it just the old-fashioned way, re-enter the URL. Okay, and of course, as noted before, events that are not really part of the market itself don't have that much impact. We have wars brewing around regions in which we have economic interests. We have an impeachment process going on in the U.S. government. We had elections two nights ago that indicated a strong possibility of a change in the control of the White House and the legislature coming up in 2020. Those seem not to do a whole lot to the markets. They see that as down there, down the road or whatever. So right now the market is just simply reacting to the good news on the trade front from China and maybe a few other things. I was going to show you something here. Maybe I can't find. I want to show you something real quick here before I go any further. It was something I should have shown you in a lecture before this, but it addresses what a few, and I am included in that, consider a defect in the way we teach finance in modern American colleges. We have all these classes where your whole entire goal is to form portfolios that have the highest return. There are contests and competitions with serious money where students can join in groups, play in groups with simulated money and try to get the highest return. That's all that matters in these, whoever got the highest return. And in fact, in the actual world of investing, you will have many television programs dedicated to investing, and this is true on YouTube as well, where all they care about is how good the return was. The fund manager who got the highest return on his fund last year is the one who is featured on the show. Or we'll have some kind of an investment type of person, and she will be given elevated status because she got the highest return. That is a very bad way to teach because it has no relationship to the risk that was taken to gain that return. You can make a fortune, well, that's great, but if you took more risk than you needed to take, then that is not great at all, and you should be given a very low grade on in a course if you did it that way. And similarly, in the real world, you're going to have to look at what is the appropriate level of risk for the people for whom I am investing. But anyway, let me take this. I'm going to draw a simple securities market line. That's the beta. And there is the expected return. The beta is on the horizontal axis. The expected return is on the vertical axis. And this helps you begin to get it in your mind a little more firmly how this actually plays out. A securities market line at any given time, and remember, this actually depends upon the moment in time when you are looking at it. The beta of one, the risk-free rate, where there's a beta of zero, something like a treasury bill, would be R sub F. That's the return to a risk-free portfolio, is R sub F. And then, with a beta of 1.0, that would be the expected return to the market portfolio. That's how you make a securities market line. The expected return, let's do that neatly. The expected return to the market portfolio would be there. And that's how we get a securities market line. And that thing will move over time. So if inflation expectations were to go up, the securities market line would elevate. If inflation expectations were to go down, it would sag. If the Fed lowered the risk-free rate, but the expected return of the market portfolio stayed the same, then the line would swing on the fulcrum of the expected return to the market portfolio. If the Fed causes the risk-free rate to go up, then that would cause this part of the line to go up, but if the expected return to the market portfolio stayed the same, then the line would pivot downward on the fulcrum of the expected return to the market portfolio. And finally, the one that was on your quiz would be something like, okay, what happens if the risk-free rate is held constant, but the expected return to the market portfolio sags? Well, then the line would pivot around downward on the risk-free rate, and the whole line would fall downward as expected return to the market portfolio fell. Okay, getting that out of the way, and I'll just say this a few more times during the course, so that by the time you get to the final, it'll be a very comfortable thing for you. Okay, we got some fund manager. Well, he got a really great return last year. Let's say that, just to put it in real perspective, let's say that the risk-free rate right now is 2.0%, and the expected return to the market portfolio is, let's say it's 12% right now. So, on the vertical axis, I'll do some hash lines, and I really should do this with a ruler and all that. I'm always fussing at students in other courses. Use a ruler to get it accurate, and here I do it this way. Okay, there's 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6, 7, 8,
10%, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15%, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20%. I'll go up to 25%. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, 25%.
Okay, those are different expected returns to portfolios. And on the beta axis, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, beta 0.5 would be a 10, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1.0, there's the 1.0 beta, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's a 1.5 beta, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's a 2.0 beta, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2.5 beta, I'm getting a little risky here, 2, 3, 4, there's a 3.0 beta, that's far enough. Okay, great, wonderful. And I hope I won't have to do this more than once. I'll be doing some very careful erasing. Okay, so in other words, the securities market line right now, it has a y-intercept of 2% right there. That is the risk-free rate right now, we'll say. Okay, great. Okay, now, a beta of 1 is the market portfolio, and that right now has an expected return of, trying to do this as accurately as possible, considering I've made the hash lines without any effort at accuracy. Okay, so in other words, the securities market line right now looks like this. Okay, right there. Now again, this is something that would be moving through time. As the risk-free rate moves, as the expected return to the market portfolio moves, you could think of this almost like a haze if you looked at it for more than just a snapshot in time. It's like if I took a very rapid picture of you, sir, you'd be handsome, dynamic, frozen in time. But if I took it for maybe instead of one 200th of a second, I took it for a second, then your eyes would be blurring. For 2 seconds, your head would move around a little bit. And for a couple of minutes, you'd do one of those paranormal things, and then suddenly be calm again. I wouldn't see that with my eyes, but there it is. Oh, God, that was really a demonic possession. Whoa. Okay, so we're right here now, just a frozen moment in time. Okay, let's say we got some guy who, this team's portfolio, they win this competition because they got a 20% return on their portfolio. They win. Others were 18, 12, 3%, 9%. Wonderful, okay? So, and there was one, it was actually somewhat like this one here, and I said, okay, what was the beta of your portfolio? I don't know. One of them was willing to calculate what the beta of that portfolio had been. Now, I am not, if I'm correct here, okay, theirs was about a 23% return. It was right about here. When he went and calculated the beta of that portfolio, he found that the beta of that portfolio was almost 2.5. That was where that portfolio was in securities market line space. Do you see that that was an awful, terrible portfolio? That portfolio sucked. You see, that return should have had a beta of maybe a little less than 2. And yet they just piled it with high risk, highly correlated in some cases, stocks, and the portfolio sure came out with a high return, but the risk that they took was entirely too much. That was an undisciplined portfolio. You, sir, are in... Do you know there's a restaurant in Texas where you can actually, if you eat this 5-pound steak within 30 minutes, you get the steak free? Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, I was there. I won. Huh? Yeah, that was, no, I mean, I was finished in like 12 minutes or something like that. One of the guys next to me was still munching on his, and I said, you going to eat that? That was back in the day. Okay. Well, that would be wonderful. You won. But man, they didn't tell you you had to eat the bone. You ate the bone. I mean, there was a big T-bone in it. You put that down. And what else did you do? Well, when the waitress came by, you ate her finger. You didn't need to do that. All you needed to do was eat the stupid steak meat. You ate the bone, you ate the waitress's finger, and then where did my cup of coffee go? The coffee's gone and the cup's gone, and you're going like that. You see, you did more than you needed. You took risks that were inappropriate. You didn't have to do that. It's like the person that was next, tailgating me this morning. I mean, he thought he had a magnetic field on his car. He could push me along. And he started flashing his lights, and I waved at him, you know, like this. And then he finally rushes around me, squeals his tires, and then he makes it to the stoplight about 3 seconds before I do. Okay? And, you know, I just started cleaning my teeth in the mirror and looking at him. You see, you didn't need to do that. So that's one of the first measures is, yeah, if you want to take risk, that's fine. That is going to get you a higher expected return. See how the securities market line works. But you have to know that there is an appropriate level of risk, and then there is risk that you should not need to take. So the competitions ignore the inappropriateness of risk. Now let me take that off the board here for just a minute. Take that off the board. Suppose that you do it by the numbers. Suppose in this case that there was a portfolio that had a beta of, let's say, 1.5. A beta, some team constructed a portfolio with a beta of 1.5. And suppose that they got a return on that portfolio, R sub P, of 18%. Okay, now watch. Here's where we do measure superior performance in portfolio management. Okay, let's take a beta of 1.5 and let's run that up here to the securities market line. Well, that portfolio would be about an expected return, to the portfolio of about 17.5. This portfolio actually outperformed the market. This portfolio should have delivered 17.5 by the capital asset pricing model. It delivered 18%. So in other words, the 18.0% that it delivered minus the 17.5% that it should have delivered is 0.50%. This one really did beat the market. We even have a name for this. We call this the Jensen's Alpha, or sometimes, mostly, we'll just call it the Alpha. It is the amount by which a portfolio exceeds, the actual return to a portfolio exceeds what it should have by CAPM. Jensen's Alpha is the amount, percentage, by which the actual return to a portfolio exceeds what it should have by the CAPM. The amount by which a portfolio, the actual return to a portfolio, the actual return to a portfolio exceeds what it should have by the CAPM. That's Jensen's alpha. And that is the actual measure that we should do in competitions. You form a portfolio. And as a matter of fact, in my investments class, that is the measure. I give them a target beta. Okay, you are managing portfolios for older households, so you want a beta of 0.8. Okay, form the portfolio. And first, you have to make sure that you stay within a few decimals of that 0.8 in portfolio management. And then at the end, you're graded on how well you kept to the 0.8. And then, okay, what was the actual return to your portfolio versus what does CAPM say the portfolio of 0.8 should, a beta of 0.8 should have returned? The higher you get, the higher your grade. Unfortunately, I had one group that had a portfolio of 0.6, and they had a return to their portfolio that was actually negative. So that was... Okay, now Jensen's alpha can be positive or negative, okay? So you could have, this portfolio might have, the CAPM says it should have pulled 17.5%. If it got 17%, that would be a Jensen's alpha of negative 0.5. Okay, so in other words, it can be positive or negative. But that's what you should look at. Mutual funds, interestingly enough, if you look carefully at the screens on them, they'll show you all kinds of different metrics of the performance of the fund. The most important one to look at is its Jensen's alpha. Is this portfolio, if given its beta, whatever the beta is of this particular mutual fund, does it outperform what it should? That's what we really mean by beating the market. You heard me say that a minute ago. If you have a Jensen's alpha that's positive, you beat the market. If you have a Jensen's alpha that's zero, you nailed the market. You got the market. If you have a Jensen's alpha that's negative, then you underperformed the market. See, the market at a beta of 1.5, the market at a beta of 1.5, is an expected return of 17.5%. That's the market at a beta of 1.5. If you get above that, then you beat the market. So simply saying, and that's a term that's very badly used. Well, this guy's stock portfolio beat the market. In other words, it was, what they're saying is it was above, let's say, the Standard & Poor's 500 or the VIX or something like that. That means nothing. It's, you're beating the market at the place where the market says your beta should return. Keep that in mind. Now, that dovetails into what I'm doing here, because when I talk about the weighted average cost of capital, that is merely the cost of something you use in your company. The weighted average cost of capital. That is the overall cost of what you use in your company. That's all it is. It really has nothing to do with the risk of the projects you take on. You would hope that your weighted average cost of capital is the bottom lowest line that a return on a project would get. So if I have a weighted average cost of capital of 8.71%, well, I kind of hope that anything that I take on is going to deliver more, at least, but more than 8.71%. So which means that if I got a project, well, I've got this project, it's got a return on investment of 6%. Well, that really doesn't do a whole lot for us. That means that it costs us more than the project is delivering. It would be like saying, well, we've got this product, we can get it at $3 a unit, and we can sell this at $2.75 a unit. Not a good idea at all. And the same as applies to capital. You want all your projects to be at least able to pay for the capital that was put in to create the project. Now, I'm going to bring up this next subject again on the last teaching day of the course. Now, after we come back from Thanksgiving, it's mostly review for the final. But the last actual class day will be, I will cover this one more time. Capital structure. Now remember, simplistically, the weighted average cost of capital is the weight of debt in the portfolio times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity in the portfolio. And in the last lecture, I nearly broke you down to misery, breaking all these. The debt has short-term and long-term. Equity has preferred and common. And then each of those has existing and new. Backing off from that, just take it like this for a minute. Capital structure, when I say that, I'm meaning the combination of debt and equity comprising total assets. And I go, and this is a pretty simplistic definition, but you remember somewhere in your dark accounting path, total assets equals liabilities plus equity, that thing. Well, it's simplistically. Well, there you go. How much of your total assets are financed by debt? How much of your total assets are financed by equity? That's all there is to it. Here's where, just do the formula. If you don't see it, just apply the formula when you're asked this on a quiz or a test or in your homework. Look, suppose that I had a company that was, its capital structure was 40% debt and 60% equity. That is not, a company's capital structure is not a mistake. It's not a consequence. It's not some random thing. Every company selects a capital structure, and it does a whole lot of things to maintain that capital structure. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But if this company is 40% debt and 60% equity, that means that it has every intention of keeping that capital structure. Well, next year maybe it'll be 50% and 50%. No, it's going to bust itself year over year. There are companies, if they start, look, if you're a company that makes a lot of money, brings it down to the bottom line, well, what that would ultimately do is swell your retained earnings. And that would mean that the equity naturally would go up over time for a successful company. If the company does not want that to happen, then it might actually simply borrow money to get its debt back up and maybe even use that money to buy back some of its debt. Borrow money and then use that money to buy back some of its stock. a company will do what it has to. As a matter of fact, I've seen offering circulars or prospectuses where it simply said, we're issuing stock to rebalance our capital structure. In other words, they had gotten their debt too high as a percent of total assets. So what they did was they simply issued some stock just to bring their equity back up to realign, get back to their optimal capital structure. I'll talk about that in a minute here. However, let me show you something. This company, 40% debt and 60% equity. That's what it wants to be. So what's going to happen here? A company has $400,000 in free cash flow available for capital expenditures this year. This company over here. Okay, now suppose that, okay, it wants to take on a $1.2 million project. Now, here's what's going to happen. Companies wouldn't do this, but here's the first thing you might think that they would do. Well, okay, they're just going to use this $400,000 to start with. And then they'll issue new stock or they'll issue debt. No, that's not what they're going to do. They're not going to do that. They're going to say, okay, we are going to keep our capital structure. That would mean that this $1.2 million project, $1,200,000 of it, that $1,200,000, we will finance 60% of it with equity. And then the remainder we will finance with debt. So So in other words, I do this right. I think I'm doing something wrong. No, I'm sorry. I did that wrong. I'm writing something wrong. I apologize for that. $1.2 million times 0.6 is how much equity we're going to put into the project. I don't know why I did the division. So in other words, we are going to spend 1.2 times 60. Boy, that was weird. I don't know what got over me there. Okay, we're going to do 1,200,000 times 0.6. So what we'll do is this project will cost $720,000 in equity. That's how much the project's equity contribution will be. And then the remainder of it, the debt contribution, would be the difference between what we put in equity, what the project costs, and what we are going to put in for equity. So the debt portion of it would be the $120 million minus $1.2 million, I'm sorry. Boy, I got off my game when I made that mistake there. Is that right? No. 1200000 minus 720000. Okay, 480,000. So in other words, we are going to spend $720,000 of equity money. Now, $400,000 of that we have. That was from operations. So, in other words, would be the total equity contribution minus available free cash flow. So in this case, what we would have is total equity contribution is going to have to be $720,000 minus what we have on hand to do that, $400,000. So $320,000 we need to go and sell new stock in order to pull that off. Again, we have $400,000 in the bank, but in order for us to keep 60%, 40%, we have to use $720,000 of equity in this $1.2 million project. Well, that would mean that if we have to use $720,000 in equity and we have $400,000 available, then that would be new stock issued. That would be the only place we could get new equity. We've burned up our internally generated equity, the $400,000. We're still short on the equity side by $320,000. That means we have to do an offering of a seasoned offering of $320,000. And the debt part, well, we just have to walk up to the bankers or to the bond markets and say we need to borrow $400,000. We need to borrow $400,000. This is actually how it's done. In other words, if you have a debt-to-equity capital structure, let's say that's 20% debt, 80% equity. You go and say to the budgeting people, I need $100,000. They are not going to give you $100,000 just out of the cash drawer. They're going to give you $80,000 from retained earnings, and then they are going to, from their borrowings, they will give you the other $20,000. That way, they stay on their optimal capital structure. That's how they do it. And this is done in every company. To the people at the operations level, they don't see this process. They just say, we need this money. It's back there in the budgeting part, in the finance part, even in the accounting part. They say, all right, we've got such and such group is going to need $500,000. Okay, they look at their capital structure and they say, okay, they're going to need, we've got like 10% debt, 90% equity. Okay, that means that we've got to pull 90% of this from our retained earnings. Oh, we don't have that much? Okay, what we have in retained earnings, that goes, and then from there, we go and get the rest by selling stock off the shelf, if they got shelf registration. And the rest, they go to the borrowers, to the lenders, rather. Now, when a small company, like, for example, a company that would be somewhat larger than mine, it's actually, it's almost organic, but it still is there. In a company like mine, I'm trying to stay at about 20% debt, 80% equity. So whenever I have some new thing that I need to do, okay, next year I'm going to buy pro panels, those nice things that are real smooth, have a nice cloth surface instead of these ugly extraordinarily heavy steel racks that I'm hauling all over the country. Okay, that's going to cost me about $15,000. Okay, that means that 15 grand, I've got to come up with 80% of that I've got to have from my retained earnings. Okay, that would mean that would be, oh God, I'm never going to get that much, $1,200 from retained earnings. And the rest, I will just go to the bank and say, all right, on my credit line, I'm going to use this $300 of borrowed money. That way, I will stay at my target capital structure. That's all there is to it. Now, last thing. On this. Debt, okay. Repeat after me. Debt is cheaper than equity.
Debt is cheaper than equity.
You're good.
Okay.
Say it to me. Debt is cheaper than equity.
Debt is cheaper than equity.
Now tell me why. See, I let him off the hook. He answered me fast. Why is debt? There are two reasons. I gave them to you. Make sure that you know them for the final exam. Two reasons that debt is cheaper than equity. Can you give me either of them? Okay, one. I'll give you a hint. One of them is that the interest on debt is tax deductible. That means that whenever I am given a debt, an interest rate, a coupon rate, whatever, I get to say 1 minus T. That's what it really costs me. It doesn't cost me 8%. It costs me 8% times 1 minus the tax rate. Debt is tax deductible, the interest is. Equity, there's no tax break at all. As a matter of fact, it is worse than no tax break at all. First of all, we're taxed, and then we pay the dividends on after tax, okay? And then even worse than that, when our shareholders get their dividend, they're hit with tax on the dividend. So it's a double whammy. Equity is a very expensive kind of capital. Debt is a cheaper kind of capital. The other reason debt is cheaper than equity is because it's lower risk. If a company is when a company has to pay its pay, the shareholders are the last who get anything, a dividend or plowback. The debt holders, if you don't pay them their interest payments and their face value, they'll end your company. They will end it right there. So, in other words, I mean, they can still lose money if there's not enough liquidated value. But realistically, they're going to get something. If a company goes into bankruptcy, oh, this company came out of bankruptcy. Well, that's great. Now, they probably negotiated some deal with the debt holders for some cut on how much they owed and all that. But the shareholders, they go home empty-handed. They get nothing at all out of it. So that means that equity is riskier than debt. So, of course, a greater risk means a greater expected return. Okay, all of that having been said, there was a proposition made some years back, and it sounded kind of stupid on its face by two very, very reputable finance scholars, economics and finance scholars. Modigliani and Miller were the names. M&M, it was called the M&M proposition. Modigliani... and Miller. The M&M proposition. It works like this. Okay. Look. Draw a simple, stupid line. A pair of axes. On the horizontal axis will be the percent of debt in the capital structure with an absolute upper bound of 100%. That would be a company that would be 100% debt. And then at the base of this horizontal axis, a 0% would mean that they use no debt in their capital structure. They use no debt. Okay, we're all good. Now, if a company uses, now this axis right here, the vertical axis, represents the weighted average cost of capital. Now I'm going to write that thing again. WAC equals weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. Now, if you look at this WAC equation, what would happen if a company had zero debt? Then that would mean if WD, the weight of debt, is zero, then that would mean that the weight of equity is 1.0. This would all mean that the WAC of a company that used no debt in its capital structure would be 0.0% debt times the cost of debt, after-tax cost of debt, plus 1.0 times the cost of equity, which means that the WAC would be nothing but the cost of equity. That's almost too much to explain. Look, if they don't use any debt, then the cost, weighted average cost of capital is just their cost of equity. So in other words, let's put the cost of equity up here, R sub E. So in other words, percent debt zero, R sub E, way up there on the vertical axis. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if the weight of debt is exactly one, that would mean that the weight of equity is zero, and the WAC equation would be 1 equals 1 times the after-tax cost of debt plus 0 times the cost of equity, which means that the WAC for a company that was 100% leveraged would be the after-tax cost of debt, which is cheaper than the cost of equity, as we just talked about. So in other words, at 100% debt, the weighted average cost of capital would be the after-tax cost of debt. So in other words, the WAC line looks like that. In other words, at 0% debt, you pay the cost of equity. At 100% debt, you pay the after-tax cost of debt, which is lower than the cost of equity. So the Modigliani-Miller proposition was this. We should never see any company that has stock. Why would any company have stock if it can finance itself more cheaply using 100% debt? I mean, why would you be anywhere along here? You know, 40% debt, 60% equity, when you could be out here 100% debt, 0% equity, and pay less for your capital. Why would any company on earth have equity in its capital structure? That was Modigliani-Miller's challenge. We shouldn't see what our lying eyes see. There are almost no companies that are 100% debt. As a matter of fact, most companies have less debt than equity in their capital structure. What the frig is going on if this is the theoretically obvious? And the answer is simple. Well, not so simple. Look. I'll try it with you, madam. You really don't like to work, do you? You know, to earn money. Wouldn't it be great if you could just stay home and just hang out with, you know, own a bunch of cats and be a cat lady and, or, you know, watch YouTube videos and maybe do a TikTok video every now and then. It'd be a nice life, wouldn't it?
Sure.
Just borrow whatever you needed. Well, you can't do that, can you? Now, sooner or later, well, they might lend you, your bank might let you borrow maybe some money at 6%. But the problem is that the more you borrow, the less likely you are going to be able to pay it off. And there will be a point where you won't have enough coming in from your internally generated abilities to be able to pay your interest payments, much less the principal. And I'll give you a good example of that. And I looked up and I'm frantically looking for last year's, and couldn't find it right off the bat, so this is 2 years ago. The institution that lends my company money, they have a schedule for me. They said borrowing anywhere from $0 to $10,000. No, that was... It was $5,000, that's right, because I thought that was increased last year, but I can't find last year's. The rate that they were going to charge me was 8.9%. And then for $5,001 up to $8,000, it was like 11.6%. And then from $8,001 up to $12,000, and I think I have these numbers right, it was going to be 15.0%. You see, the more I borrowed, the higher the marginal cost of the debt was. This is the way it is with all companies. When companies borrow money, the first time, the coupon rate is going to be pretty low. But then, as they borrow more and more, the investors, the lenders, see more risk that they can't pay it because they've got their debt burden is building. This is what happened with Netflix. Netflix borrowed money at first at low coupon rates, decent coupon rates. This last time, they stepped up to the plate for a staggering amount of money. They issued bonds. Or they call them notes, so I still call them bonds. They were 15-year paper. And the coupon they had to pay in order to get par on the bonds, what made them junk bonds. They had to pay so much because Netflix is showing so much risk. I mean, yeah, they'll probably be able to pay it off, but it's getting a little bit scary. Lenders are saying, okay, this is risky, and we're going to lend you the money because we're risk takers, but you are going to have to give us a coupon that reflects that risk. And so that's why these last bonds that Netflix issued, some analysts were calling them junk bonds because their coupon rate was so high. And this is true with any company. What does that mean for the Modigliani-Miller? This is not a straight line, downward sloping line. At first, when a company borrows money, it will pay kind of like a flat rate, cheaper than equity. But there comes a point where the company begins to borrow so much money that it begins to bottom out. And then as they borrow more, it gets really expensive to borrow. So the real world version of the Modigliani-Miller line is not a line at all. It slopes downward and then it comes back up. So that if the company were 100% leveraged, that company would be junk bonds. And yes, we've seen those. These completely leveraged companies, what happens? Yeah, we see them. They're 100% debt. And that debt is all super junk. They're paying coupons that are staggering on that debt. This is what happens, is that at first borrowing money, you borrowed at a low rate. But it doesn't stay cheaper than equity. Eventually, the debt starts to eat. The cost of debt goes up, just like it does for me. See how, as I borrow extra money above each of these breakpoints, I end up paying more? And so it gets to the point where at here, really, realistically, it's still cheaper to borrow. If I needed more than 12 grand, it's still cheaper to borrow than it would be to go out and get equity, new investors, but there's that. But anyway, okay. See this right here? This bottoming out point has a name. It's called the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. Now, Madam, you have been in this class now for what? 11 weeks, maybe something like that? 12 weeks? If I say a definition three times, do you think that means it's kind of important to know for an exam? You think? Yeah, good. You're going to do fine. I've said this three times now. Every company has its own particular WACC curve. Interestingly, industries have their own WACC, have relatively similar WACC curves. So in this case, this company looks like it's about 45% debt, which would mean 55% equity. That would be its optimal capital structure. And that's why, as I said near the beginning of this lecture, companies bust their butts to hold that. When they do projects, they don't use just equity or just debt. They use the same combination that is their optimal capital structure. That way, they always are staying on the optimal capital structure. And if a company essentially earns too much money, it's building too much in retained earnings relative to its debt load, it will actually start to find that its weighted average cost of capital, it has too much equity in it, which means it's too expensive. That's why they would start borrowing, issuing debt to back them back down. On the other hand, a company could say, okay, we're supposed to be 45% debt. Well, right now, we're like 60% debt. Okay, you need to sell stock and use that stock to pay off some of your debt. See, because as you sell stock, that's issuing stock, you become more equity laden, and that also, if you use that money to pay off your debt, that takes your debt percentage down and you're back where you want to be. Okay. These are kind of rough. They are pretty rough, but let me show you. Like I said, every company will have its own unique optimal capital structure line. Like you can see some companies, you can see even some industries where the WACC curve turns back upward at a very low debt level. In other words, this company would be like maybe 15-20% debt. And commensurately, 80% equity. Then you'll see some firms that actually are, interestingly enough, kind of the opposite. They can sustain optimal capital structures that are heavy leverage. Some industries are like that. The factors that govern this are still, a few of them are debated, but in general, you can have them all over the place. Like, for example, my company has a weighted average cost of capital like that, which is also, interestingly enough, very typical of fine arts companies. And then you have some of the heavy companies, bigger companies that borrow huge amounts of money. Their capital structures are heavily weighted toward debt. And then you have these ludicrously, and I have promised you that I will show you how to become millionaires. I'll do that on Tuesday. In order to do that, you're in an industry, it's like a cottage industry. It's people, couples, little partnerships do this. Their optimal capital structure is nearly 100% debt. In other words, the way you can make a fortune over a period of 5 to 10 years is because you are using almost exclusively OPM. Madam, do you remember what OPM is? Other people's money. No, seriously, that's how you do this trick. And it is well known, and it's made a lot of multimillionaires. And, of course, it's also made a lot of those people you see on the street who smell bad and they sleep by the grates in the winter. You can either score hugely. But in order to pull that off, to do that kind of to play in that industry, you're playing where the weighted average cost of capital curve is going down rapidly, clear out to like 90% debt, 10% equity. And like I said, I will spend the time on Tuesday to show you how you can become a millionaire. And then that means you will never, ever have to take a course like this again, because you will be the finance genius. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.